this is going on late.
So we then have a regression line like that. And what is that regression line in the form of? It's in the Fourier. It turns out to be the regression that's 0.28 plus one. So the highest LSAT is 185. So 185 plus LSAT minus 140. How much above 140 the LSAT is? Times, that's going to go up to about 40, and so let's just call it times 0.01. So that tells us that on average, every point of LSAT raises by 1% your chance of passing the bar.
All right.
For this particular school, we've got one school and we're doing a regression to show how for that school, bar passage probably depends on LSAT. People follow what I'm doing so far? And here, this is one of your regression coefficients. This is a constant term. This 0.28 is the intercept, and this 0.01 is the slope. And now, this is useful in two different ways. First, we can say, all right, that's Hastings or something, and this is Harvard. Well, Harvard's got much higher bar passage rates than Hastings does, but in fact, it's a worse school, if that's the way the line's going. Because what are we seeing? We're seeing at any given LSAT, there's a lower problem. Now, of course, the line might cross, it doesn't have to be this simple. But my point is that if you did it as just a simple regression and sort of described, you have a way of doing a fancier version of your wanting to pair up equal things. But there's a second big benefit from this. Because who is going to, aside from saying which school is better or worse, the ABA wants to certify schools. But who is this information really valuable to?
Students.
Does the enter a student? Because the enter student is, aha, here are the coefficients. I can do arithmetic. I know what my LSAT is. Go to Hastings, 0.6 probability. Go to Harvard, if you let me in, 0.5 probability. That's easy. Harvard costs a lot more. So if they actually did it, what I'm claiming is right, obviously one can disagree on what is or isn't right, it seems to me that they would both do a better job of deciding what law schools to say were good and provide much better and more useful information to students. Yeah?
But then you only have information for each state passage, right? So Harvard, California passage and Santa Clara, California passage. And then for some schools, you might not have anybody entering the California bar because
it would work much better for comparing schools within California to each other or schools within.
Well, not within California, just students who wish to take California.
But I'm guessing that schools outside of California, they're much less likely, so you won't have nearly as much data.
Well, I think the Harvard might, or like a big name school, something like
that. Maybe. You might in some cases. But no, I agree that one limitation is that I've really been thinking about this within the California context as if there was only one bar, and you'd obviously have further complications from that. But my basic point is just that the real information you want is value added by the school, and you don't measure that by outcome. All right. So this is here. I've got a bar passage rate equals A plus B times LSAT, and then there might be, I'm just taking LSAT here, but there might be some other characteristics that you thought were relevant that you would want to use as well. The higher A and B, the better the school. Some schools may do well with low LSAT students, some with high, because you could imagine a case where, in fact, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if what you would really get if you looked at Harvard, and I don't know how good or bad Hastings is, I'm just taking it as the school that's about to be famous. It might turn out that what was really happening was that for good and high LSAT students, Harvard did much better because of and Hastings are really bright students sitting there twiddling their thumbs, thinking about how good they are, getting A's with no work, and then failing the bar. But at the same time, it might well be that at Harvard, if you're not really smart, you're completely lost, frustrated, don't understand what's going on in class. So it could easily not be that the line can cross, and then that doesn't tell you, it doesn't tell the ABA who they should approve of, but it tells the students which school they're going to, according to how good they are at those measures. Oopsie. Oh, that's just my charger, which is not an issue because I've got another hour and a half or 2 hours on the battery, I think. So, you could argue then that what the Bar Association really should do is to say that both of those schools get certified, that basically we certify both schools that are good with good students and schools that are relatively good with bad students, and the only ones we decertify are the ones that are bad with everybody, essentially. And that would seem like a more sensible procedure. All right. I've got on the syllabus some more homework. Again, it does not have to be handed in, but it seemed to me that it probably was worth your getting your fingers a little bit dirty, so to speak. So the form of the homework this time is you've actually given the data, and you're supposed to calculate things like a correlation coefficient. However, so as to make life not too hard for you, it's like 5 data points. Four for one of them and 5 for the other, as I remember. So it seemed to me that you have a clearer idea of what we're doing if, in addition to the words, you've actually at some point taken some numbers and calculated an R-squared or a correlation coefficient. But if you're doing it with a calculator, you don't really want to do it for 100 data points. How many of you both have a spreadsheet and know how to use it? So,
a little bit.
All right. The reason I ask is that I'm not sure if it's worth doing this year, but that I could have you do the same thing with lots of data if you used a spreadsheet, not using the statistical functions, because then you wouldn't learn anything because they already have the stuff built in. But if I say, all right, here are a bunch of points, actually calculate the correlation coefficient yourself. You can check it. I'm sure Excel has a correlation coefficient function, but that's not interesting. But if you want to just once go through the mechanics and say, where did the correlation coefficient come from? All right, what do? You take the mean of this sum of this set. Well, what's that? The sum divided by the number. You take the mean of this. That's the sum divided by the number. For each of them, you take that number minus the mean. That's its deviation from the mean, and so forth. Go through the way it's calculated. And that way, you would actually have once done it. And that's what I'm having you do. What I'm having you do with 5 numbers instead of 100 numbers, because I wasn't sure if I could count on your. It didn't really occur to me, actually, you could use a spreadsheet, although I do for that sort of thing. But I was sort of thinking about it, and it seems to me that a spreadsheet would be a nice compromise between using a statistics program where you really have no idea what's going on inside at all, and doing it with pencil and paper, where it's just too damn much work to do very much of it. So those ones are there. I thought it would be useful, given that we're approaching the end of the course, as sort of the summary of the statistics part of the class, to discuss the question of what you ought to know, and along with that, what you don't really have to know, what it seems to me is reasonable to expect you to get out of the statistics part of this class. And let me run through these things and sort of stop me for the ones that you don't think you understand, and I will explain if I can. You ought to understand about different ways of displaying and summarizing data. All right, so what can you do? Well, you can take a bunch of numbers and draw a histogram. What is a histogram? A histogram occurs with just one variable, and all you're really showing is how many examples there are of each. So we say, all right, here is the population of San Jose. How many people are 21? How many are 22? How many are 23? Draw a histogram in which, if there are, this is the population of San Jose, and there are 1,000 people 0 to 1, and a little bit more than that for some reason, a little older, and a little more than that, a little older than that. And maybe the peak age is up around here, and then old people go off to Florida, so we don't have very many people. And then eventually, old people die, and so when you get to about 100, it drops to about 0. All right, that's what a histogram would show you. All it's just a single variable, namely age, and all you're doing is a count of people for that. And for some purposes, that's going to be useful and important, right? It's just a simple way of eyeballing. Instead of saying, here's a pile of numbers, it's a way of eyeballing. You understand that?
Yes.
Okay. Next one is mean and median. Those are single number ways of summing up some data. Average height is this, the average weight is this, the average age of our students is this, anything of that sort. All right. I think you probably all know that sort of pretty basic, and you want to think a little bit about how you would choose among them. When is the median a more useful statistic? When is the mean the more useful statistic? If your opponent in the case is using the median, why might that bias the result in his direction, in which case you want the mean, and vice versa. All right? Suppose the question is, what's a reasonable damage award for this kind of injury? And your opponent says, well, the mean award for this kind of injury is $10,000. What might you think about that might make you wonder if perhaps you should argue for using the median instead? Especially if they were very different.
Well, the mean was the result of one really big award.
That's right. You might say, yeah, sure, that's true. But in fact, there have been 15 such cases. And in 14 cases, they thought it was $1,000. And in one case, there was this wonderful, wonderful plaintiff's attorney who gave a enormous description of how terrible the injury was, or maybe it was a case where the victim was an extremely sympathetic victim and the injury injured her voice and she was an opera star. I mean, you think of a lot of reasons why it might be an atypical case, and one case that's way out of line is going to push the mean but have no effect on the median. So things like, I mean, concepts like that, I'm not saying you're going to be tested on all these things. Some of these things in the list I'm giving are things I wouldn't expect to put on exam just because there's no easy way to test them on them. But after all, the real point of the course isn't to pass the exam. The point of the course is to learn useful stuff, and I'm trying to describe stuff that I think you can reasonably hope to have learned that is going to be useful. Second thing, which will put you way ahead of not merely most lawyers, but most economists, sociologists, psychologists, other academics, is actually understanding what terms like significant and confidence interval mean. And the basic framework of all of this is that you're testing a hypothesis, testing a conjecture. You are saying, the conjecture is that the average age of students at Santa Clara is 20, at Santa Clara Law School is 24 entering students. The conjecture is that boys and girls are equally that boys are on average neither relatively better nor relatively worse at math compared to verbal than girls. The conjecture is that there are really two conjectures: the null hypothesis and a positive conjecture. Put it the other way around. The conjecture is law students at Santa Clara on average are older than 24. The conjecture is boys, on average, do relatively better at math and worse on verbal than girls. The conjecture is that power lines cause cancer. The null hypothesis is that the conjecture is false. And what you're doing in all of these is implicitly you've got a conjecture and a null hypothesis. And you're saying the conjecture says the data ought to be in this direction. The null hypothesis tells us what we would expect the data to be. How likely is it that we would get the result that our conjecture implies as strongly as we do if the null hypothesis is true? So if it is true that boys and girls are equally good at, relatively good at math and verbal, how likely is it that the relative scores of boys math to verbal would be 10 points above those of girls, suppose we observe it? If the average age of law students that's entering Santa Clara is 24, how likely is it that the 15 entering students I interviewed would have an average age of 27, if and so forth? All right? And so in all of these cases, you have the conjecture that the boys are better than the girls and we're at math and worse at verbal, the conjecture that the students are older than 24, the conjecture of whatever it is. And you have a null hypothesis, which is there ain't nothing here. You know, nobody here but us chickens. You know that story, don't you?
Right. No, I've heard that one. It's in line.
Southern farmer, I think. I think it's Southern. It doesn't have to be Southern, but somehow Southern is the way I hear it. And he hears a suspicious noise in his hen house. And he goes out with his shotgun and sort of looks and says, anybody there? And he gets the voice from the house, ain't nobody here but us chickens, boss. Anyway, so So in all of these, what your significance or the confidence interval is basically telling you is, if the null hypothesis is true, if the thing you're looking for isn't there, how likely is it that the evidence that it is there would be as good as it is? That's a very simple summary of what a significance result is a statement about. And if you understand that, as I say, you're ahead of most people who talk about significance results, because most of them don't. Do people understand the distinction between a one-tailed and a two-tailed test? That is, the one-tailed test would be our conjecture is that law students are older than 24. The two-tailed would be if your conjecture is 24 isn't the right average age, but I don't know if they're older or younger. Because if the conjecture is that they're older than 24, then when the students you interview turn out to have an average age of 23, that's not confirm your conjecture. But if your conjecture is that it's not 24, then 23 is at least weak evidence for the conjectures. Better evidence than 24 would be. What?
Can you repeat what you said?
The one-tailed test, you have an expectation that one's going to be on the other side of the other.
Okay, so there's no direction necessarily, it's just one or the other.
One-tailed, it could be higher or lower, but the point is the one-tailed is your conjecture is the null hypothesis is wrong in this direction.
Okay.
Two-tailed is the null hypothesis is wrong.
Right.
So for a given piece of evidence...
Two-tailed, is that refer to a datagram?
Yeah, you're thinking... You're thinking about something... Not that it would be a normal distribution, but I could show it easily enough for the normal distribution. You're implicitly imagining...
Thank you.
There's your normal distribution. You say, if... Here's the mean. You say, if the null hypothesis is true. Can you see this?
Yes, sir.
Right. If the null hypothesis is true, it's quite likely that we would observe a number around here. It gets less and less likely as we go out. The single tail, we say, well, we actually observed a number here. This is in the face of it. If the null hypothesis is right, then the chance we would observe a number at least that far out is going to be the area under. So the probability that we would have evidence this good is only that relative to the area of the whole thing. If the conjecture is not that the real number is higher, but it's either higher or lower, then we say, well, it's true. We have only this chance that the evidence is this far above would exist. But we've also got this chance that we would get by random chance something that far below. Either of those would look like evidence against the null hypothesis. Probability of getting one or the other of these is twice as high as the probability of getting one of them. So therefore, if the guess was only the null hypothesis was false, getting this result would be half as good evidence, as it were, as if what we were looking for evidence was that it was false in this direction.
A particular example, not the only one of using these ideas, is the null hypothesis, central limit theorem, and the z-test. And what you're doing there is you're saying that for many, though not all, distributions, if we look not at the distribution itself, but at the distribution of the average of samples from it, if we say, here is a distribution of ages, suppose we pick 20 people and take their average age. Pick another random 20 and take their average age. The distribution of those averages tends to be about normal. And as the size of the sample whose mean we're taking goes up, the standard deviation of the means goes down. But the larger the sample it is, the closer you're usually going to get to the true mean. And it turns out, for reasons which you just have to remember, that the actual rule is that the standard deviation of the mean goes down as the square root of the number of observations. So if you're looking at the mean of 100 observations, the amount by which that'll vary is about a tenth as much. It's about a tenth as much as if you're looking at a single observation, because the square root of 100 is 10. All right? So given that, any of the kind of experiments, such as we've been through before, and there's, I think, one on the homework, where we say, all right, we We have a guess about the mean of something. Here is a sample. Here is how far the mean of that sample was from our guess. Is that strong evidence that our guess was wrong? And in any of those, you say, all right, you estimate the standard deviation of a single observation by looking at the observations in your sample, each of them separately. You then say, what should the standard deviation of the mean be? That number divided by square root of the number of things in the observation. And you then say, all right, how many standard deviations of the mean is this mean away from our conjectural figure? That's the Z figure. You then look up on a table to see how likely that is. Yes, no? Want me to go over it again? Or? So we've been through that a few times. It's just one example of a statistical procedure that's simple enough so you could do it or at least understand it when somebody else does it. Next thing that you ought to know is, what does a correlation coefficient show? Correlation coefficient shows how nearly linear the relationship between two variables is. The correlation coefficient does not tell you how strong the relationship is, but it does tell you how nearly they are in a straight line and whether the line slopes up or down. Positive slopes up, negative slopes down. Regression results, and the basic logic is the same. Single regression is one where you say we have a dependent variable which we think depends on one independent variable. So we say our conjecture is that bar passage rate depends on LSAT. Multiple regression is our conjecture is that it depends on your LSAT, your GPA, how old you are, maybe a couple of other things. Basic logic is the same. It just gets more complicated with more variables. And a regression result gives you two kinds of information I discussed before. One is, how strong does the relationship appear to be? When LSAT changes by one, how much does that push up your chance or down, presumably up your chance of passing the bar? And the other question is, how sure are you of how strong it is? And in particular, how sure are you that it's positive for you? Usually, what the T statistic measures really is, how sure are you the coefficient isn't zero? Coefficient zero means this has no effect at all. And so, just as in the stuff we were discussing before, you can say, all right, how much, given the size of the statistics we're doing, how much just randomly would we expect that coefficient to vary? If the answer is the coefficient is 3, but next time we measure it, it might be 5, and next time it might be 1, because given a small sample size, it's a very there's a lot of random noise, as it were, in what happened, then we're not really sure it's there at all. If 3, 3.1, 2.9, 3.2, 2.93, all right, it's there. All right, so you're looking at both how strong the effect is and how good your reasons are to think the effect is there. That's what a t-statistic is a measure of. It's just like a z, except being used for a different purpose. Same idea.
It's
conceptually just like a z, except right, that you're using the z. We were using the z when we were looking at was standard deviation of a mean, and we're looking at the t when we're looking at the standard deviation of a regression coefficient.
Okay.
All right. But in both cases, we're really saying, given random chance, how much would this number vary? How big is this number? Is the amount it would randomly vary large enough, given its size, so it might really be zero? So that the whole effect we're looking at might just be the accident of the sample we happen to pick, rather than a real effect. All right. So if we say, suppose we take gender ratio. Suppose we say, all right, we've picked 15 students at random and 10 of them are female. And my guess is that even if the actual student body is about 50-50, it wouldn't be unlikely that with a group as small as 15, it would turn out to be 10 women and 5 men. Quite unlikely to turn out to be 14-1. And so that's, again, a significance.
That's more of a z-test.
That particular one would be done by a z-test, but the regression coefficient would be where we looked at how bar passage varied with LSAT. That's a regression.
Right.
The regression gives us a coefficient. It says each 1 point of LSAT raises your bar passage rate by 0.01.
Right.
We want to know how sure are we that number is really 0.01 and not zero. And we say, well, all right, given the size of the sample, you can predict how much that thing is going to randomly vary. And if it's going to randomly vary enough so that sometimes you'll get that effect when there's nothing there at all, then you don't really have very much good reason to believe it. The regression result, the R-squared is a figure for the whole regression. The R-squared basically tells you how much of the variation in what you're looking at is explained by the regression. The T is a statistic for a single coefficient. The T says, how sure are we that there's a relationship with that Barr-Pathies rate goes up with LSAT. Whereas R-squared would say how much of the variation in Barr passage rate is explained by LSAT, GPA, and the two other things you put into our regression. And you sometimes use changes in R-squared, you sometimes say, all right, if we put in LSAT and age, we get an R-squared of 0.7. That explains, in some sense, 70% of the variation. How about if we put in LSAT, age, and GPS? It goes up from 70% to 71%. Sorry, GPS, GPA. In that case, the GPA isn't adding very much. And your suspicion then is maybe just GPA, maybe just LSAT probably isn't worth trying to put both of them in because it's not much additional information. And then the final thing you ought to know is what can go wrong. That's part of it, the stuff we did early on, is how you can present statistical data in a way that will mislead. And we've been through a bunch of ways you can do that, and how, when you actually do statistics, when you do a regression, what are the ways in which it might intentionally or unintentionally mislead? So that, for example, it might show both GPA and LSAT to be insignificant. Why? Because you've got both of them in the regression. They're highly collinear. I guess, I don't know, but I'm guessing they are. And therefore, once you've got one, the other doesn't add much information, whichever one you start with. And therefore, each of them, you're not sure it's significant. But you can think of other things. The obvious other thing is when you've got a missing variable and you say that that we believe that age correlates with whether you're going to get cancer, or year you were born correlates whether you're going to get cancer, we've left out the fact that smoking rates change during that period of time, and that's the real variable. So you can think of sort of a bunch of different ways that things can go wrong, different ways that you can do statistics, perhaps honestly, perhaps not, and get a result that's really a bogus result. All right. What you are not expected to do, we don't expect you to actually be able to do regressions. And the only regression I'm having you do in the homework, you're just eyeballing and drawing a line that you think is a rough fit. If you ever need to do a regression, you will either find some statistics software and figure out how it works, or you'll hire a statistician. We don't expect you to be able to prove things. I can't prove the central limit theorem, so there's no reason why you should be able to. I don't expect that, a month after you've taken this class, you will be able to give me an exact definition of what a correlation coefficient is. But I do expect that you will know about what it measures, what it tells you, so to speak. But 2 days from now, you'll probably know exactly what a correlation coefficient is because I'm giving you a problem where you can look it up in the book and see where you're supposed to calculate a correlation coefficient. Maybe you'll remember, maybe you won't, but you don't have to remember. It isn't important. Similarly, be nice if you knew that a linear regression is doing a least squares fit, but if that's just gibberish, it doesn't much matter as long as you have the conceptual idea that it's trying to draw a line that comes close to fitting the set of points. Similarly, you should know that the R-squared tells you, roughly speaking, how much of the variation in whatever your dependent variable is the regression explains. That doesn't mean you can write out a mathematical definition of an R-squared. So you want to understand enough not to be fooled, to know what questions you should ask, and to know about what the answers mean. That's a sort of very simple summary of what law students need from statistics. And I would appreciate it if between now and Thursday you would both look at the homework problems, but also start going through everything we've done and say, what don't you understand that you'd like me to discuss in class for the next 2 days, because that's what we're really going to be doing for the next two classes, trying to go back. And I'll probably have a summary of everything, but it's on the whole more productive if I spend my time on things you don't understand than on things you do. I like to claim that when you're giving a talk, the nice thing about answering questions is that when you're answering questions, you know at least one person in the audience is interested in what you're talking about.